So we're 5 minutes late, so I'm going to have to be slightly quicker. So to those who don't know, what I'm going to talk about is the DSi. It's the successor of the DS, which is, you know, the first dual screen console by Nintendo, which is basically two GBAs with a new GPU. The DSi runs basically the same games, but it also has cameras and a web browser and more fancy things. There's also the successor, which is the 3DS, which has the 3D effect, which is actually completely new. It has a new CPU, a new GPU, and so on. But it's the middle one I'm going to talk about today. But before I get started about the DSi, I'm first going to spend a few minutes talking about the DS, which is going to explain why the DSi is actually different. The DS was the first console by Nintendo to use cryptography, but they made a mistake of using symmetric key cryptography, which means that the key to encrypt a cartridge is the same key used to decrypt, which has to sit in your console. So if that key gets leaked, you can make your own cartridges, which is exactly what happened. Like these flashcards, these R4 cards, etc., got really popular, and Nintendo didn't like that because that way, just using a flashcard is really easy. People are going to use it, compared to the GameCube. In the GameCube, you had to use a mod chip, which you have to solder, so not many people did that. But yeah, that means that for that point on, Nintendo had to use public key cryptography, which does not have this problem, which means they actually completely changed and used a completely different security system in the DSi as compared to the DS. Now, of course, the DS was released 15 years or so ago, so of course I'm not the first one to ever look into the DSi. And the first one to actually propose a console was Scanline with her RAM tracer. She built this kind of impressive setup where she could do MITM attacks against the external RAM bus. So that way she could see every read and write happening on that bus, and that way she could extract code of games and then find vulnerabilities in them, and then you have the same game vulnerabilities, which is on the small spy eMMC on the cartridge, and that way you can get easier ways of getting code execution. But that's like all that. The setup was pretty fancy, but that's still everything that was possible to do with that. And yeah, nothing else really happened after that. There's no deeper way into getting into the console, so yeah, things stalled a bit. And then the 3DS got released, and you may have seen these presentations at previous congresses, and yeah, it got pretty badly broken. And interestingly, after the 3DS got broken, Unlaunch appeared, which is a bootcode exploit for the DSi. And you would think, okay, we have a bootcode exploit, we can run our own unsigned code right at cold boot, so problem solved, right? Well, not really. Unlaunch has some weird things. It also exploits a second stage bootloader, which sits in the eMMC, so it has to modify the eMMC in, people don't really like modifying the eMMC because the eMMC in the DSi is actually really bad. It wears out really quickly, and then as soon as the eMMC breaks, your console is a brick, and that's not good. Also, the boot ROM hasn't been extracted, and yeah, we want a boot ROM. So, but instead of using a fancy attack, maybe we can just revive a console by just replacing the eMMC chip. It's just not basic, generic, non-volatile memory, right? Well, not quite. The eMMC card identifier, which is a read-only ID that's unique to every eMMC chip, is actually used to derive keys that are used in a bunch of things. And also the console ID, which is a fuse in the main SoC, that also uses a source for keys. So that means if one of these things changes, for example, if you replace the SoC on a motherboard, or if you replace the eMMC on a motherboard, your console won't be able to boot. So yeah, that's also a problem, and it's also one of the reasons why secure boot is just not a good thing. Anyway, before I can continue, let's talk about hardware. The DSi has two ARM CPUs. There's the ARM9, which runs at 133 megahertz. It has, it runs most of the game code. It has access to the GPU, but it's not in this diagram because it's not super important. There's also the ARM7, which runs 4 times slower, but it has all access to all the I/O stuff. Both cores communicate using a FIFO interface. They each have a little bit of private RAM that only that core can see. There's also the CRPS RAM, which is 16 megabytes in size. It's the biggest memory. It's also the external memory that Scanline attacked. There's also WRAM, and WRAM is weird because it's divided into a bunch of physical blocks of memory, and each of these physical blocks can be separately assigned to one of the cores at a flexible address, but it's only then visible to that core, but also the mapping can change at runtime, so it gets complicated pretty quickly. So let's talk about how the console boots. So there's the SoC, which has both of the CPU cores, some RAM, it has the boot ROMs and all the peripherals, for example, the AES engine. The MMC is the non-volatile memory, and there's also the DRAM. The first thing that starts running when you boot the SI is the boot ROM. It sits in mask ROM. It loads the second boot stage from raw MMC blocks. It sends it to the AES engine. That went decrypted, and then it gets loaded into SRAM. The second stage then gets also started. It then loads the system menu from the FAT file. System also decrypts that, loads it into DRAM this time, and the system menu starts running. And this is actually the first thing that actually turns on the screens, and then you get the nice boot logo. And yeah, then the system menu is able to launch your game from a game cartridge or maybe from EMMC. And that gets loaded into DRAM. But before the system menu actually jumps to the game code, it's going to apply what's called the sconfig registers. These are used to power gate certain parts of the hardware, and they cannot be turned on again until the console is reset and then the entire boot flow happens again. That's used because there's no operating system, there's no hypervisor or anything inside the DSI, so this is the only way to make sure that when a game is running that runs from a cartridge, it should not have any access to the EMMC to corrupt it or do any other kinds of evil things. So that's an interesting way to do isolation here. Now, of course, the 3DS is also not completely irrelevant. It has a backwards compatible mode to run DS and DSi games. And the interesting thing is that instead of running a software emulator, the hardware of the 3DS actually reconfigures itself and starts pretending to be a DSi. This switch is implemented in low-level firmware, so when you start a DSi game on your 3DS, it will actually shut down the operating system of the 3DS and then run some kind of low-level firmware that then does the mode switch. And once that mode switch happens, the first thing that runs in DSi mode is actually the standard second stage bootloader. And that's interesting because it's exactly the same one as on the stock regular DSis. So yeah, of course, it's loaded into SRAM, so with Scanline's RAM tracer, you can't really read it out. But because it's leaked by the 3DS firmware, now you can actually read all the code and find vulnerabilities, and that's exactly how unlaunch happened. So yeah, the main takeaways here is that if your EMMC is dead, your console is a brick, and everything that's interesting and has been hacked already happens after the signature check. And that means that if your EMMC is that any sort of hack that's already been published for the DSI, it won't help you, and you still have a brick. So if we want to fix this, we need some way to get code execution super early. Now, nobody has the boot ROMs yet, at least when I started on this. And doing black box, trying to find a vulnerability here is not fun, so we really needed a way to get the boot ROMs. Now, the 3DS has this interesting thing where there's a hardware flaw that using fall injection, you can actually extract the boot ROMs. And this actually also works on the DSi. So it works as follows. It's called vector glitch hack. Both CPU cores have their own separate boot ROMs. These are divided into three sections. There is the exception vectors, which have things like the reset handler, which is the first code that runs on reset. It jumps to the boot code. There's things like the interrupt handlers, which fire when a button is pressed, for example. There's the software interrupt, which jumps to the utility routines. And there are also other things like handlers for when an invalid memory access happens or when an illegal instruction is executed. And of course, the boot code can also be disabled using the sconfig registers, so you need to extract the boot code before that happens, because otherwise it's stuck until the console is rebooted again, just like the other time. Now, of course, for some things like the utility routines or the boot code, that's fine to be hard-coded into the boot ROM, but for the exception vectors and the interrupt vector, you want to do different things when a button is pressed. For example, for like if you're in a menu, you want to navigate in the menu. If you're running a game, maybe you want the player character to shoot something. So that has to be, there needs to be some way to change the behavior of that at runtime. So for that, they actually made the boot ROM such that some exception handlers jump to RAM. And there's an interesting thing is that this piece of RAM actually persists across resets. So if we fill this with a payload and an opslet for a good measure, and then we reset the chip, you know, the reset exception handler will run, this jumps to the boot code, regular boot code will run, everything is fine. But if we now inject a fault here, and if we are lucky, this will cause an undefined instruction exception, which means it's going to jump back to the undefined instruction exception handler. This jumps into RAM, right into our payload, and that way you get ARM7 code execution in the boot ROM. Now, I wasn't the first person to think about this. There's like forum posts about this in like 2016 or 2017, but they didn't really get any success at this. Why is that? Well, let's talk about how glitching works in practice. So let's quickly talk about voltage glitching. This is a CMOS inverter. If you don't exactly know how it works, it doesn't really matter. The important thing is that it has an input and output. There's two transistors. There's the positive supply voltage and the ground. If you have an input, if your input is a zero, the upper transistor will turn on. It will connect the output to the positive power supply. That means the output is going to be a logical one. Now, if you short the positive power rail to the ground, the output will be a zero, even though the input is zero, which means there's a fault here. Now, if you do this for a long amount of time, that means that means the chip is going to shut down because it doesn't have any power, so you shouldn't do that. If you do this for a very short amount of time, this chip will actually keep running, but it still has the wrong output, and it's going to use that in the computations after that, and it's maybe going to store it into some kind of RAM, etc., and that's going to cause all sorts of bad things. Now, in practice, if you look at the PCB, there are these things on it. These are called decoupling capacitors. These hold a tiny amount of charge, and those will actually smooth out any sort of glitches. And the people who tried this didn't really take this into account. They didn't really, either they used way too long glitches or way too short ones. They hadn't really a way to precisely time this and other things. So yeah, that ended up not working. Luckily, there is a different way to inject faults, which is called electromagnetic fault injection, or EMFI for short. The way that works is that if you have a coil, like here on the left, if you run a huge voltage spike for that, for example, like 400 volts for a few nanoseconds, that's going to generate an electromagnetic pulse around that coil. Now, at the right, there's a 3D rendering of how a chip looks like. At the bottom layer, there's all the silicon with all the transistors that get all the attention here. But above that, there's the gold color thing, which is the metal interconnect. These are actually the metal wires, the metal connections that connect all the transistors, which allows them to actually do any useful work. Now, if the interconnect is hit by an electromagnetic pulse, that's going to induce currents, through the law of induction, etc. And all sorts of currents are going to flow and also cause bad things. And for that, you don't need to care about the decoupling capacitors or where on the PCB the power rails are and so on. So that's pretty easy. Of course, you need more specialized equipment. Luckily, I have that because I have access to a fancy lab. So it, in practice, it looks like this. So you have, the what's left of a DSI with the main SoC. And right above that, there's a small coil, which is then connected to a pulse generator. If we zoom out a bit, it looks like this. The pulse generator is fit on an XYZ stage, so you can actually move the rounds and target different areas of the chip. At the very bottom of the picture, there is a breadboard with a Raspberry Pico and a few other things, which can quickly reboot a chip. Actually activate the pulse generator and talk to whatever is running on the DSI and so on. And it uses a mess of wires, so I actually had to use aluminum foil to shield it from the pulse generator because otherwise it wouldn't really work. So yeah. But yeah, eventually this worked. I was able to read out the boot ROM. But there's a small problem here. The ARM7 code only has like driver code and all the boring stuff, but if you want to make an exploit, you actually want to see what the juicy cryptographic code is doing, and yeah, we didn't have it. So we're going to have to dump the ARM9 boot ROM. And well, on the 3DS, it was pretty easy. As soon as you have code execution on one of the cores, you can basically take over the other core and read out whatever they have. But that doesn't quite work on the DSi. Instead, well, maybe we can just try the same thing again, but that also doesn't work because on the ARM9, that piece of RAM is actually does get reset. So yeah, you also can't really use that. So we're going to need to think of a different attack here. Sorry. So yeah, here's a rough overview of how the boot ROM works. So both cores do some initialization stuff. The ARM7 then loads whatever it has to load, sends it to the ARM9. The ARM9 does whatever cryptographic verification routines it does, which we don't really know yet. It sends the result back to the ARM7. If everything is good, if the RSA signatures are valid, the ARM7 will actually lock away the boot ROMs of both cores instead of every core doing it for themselves. And then the ARM9 wait for that locks to happen. And you know, as soon as that's done, they go on to the next boot stage. Now, if we use the vector glitch hack to take over the ARM7 as usual, but instead of just dumping the boot ROM, we now pretend to be the ARM7 boot ROM, except we quote unquote forget to lock the boot ROMs. That will first get the ARM9 to get stuck in an infinite loop, and it's just going to wait for something that won't ever happen. But then we can just inject a second fault. And that fault will hopefully make the ARM9 jump out of that loop, even though it shouldn't. And then the console will just continue boot as if everything is fine. So if we then zoom out, it will just go to the next boot stage. And eventually, using some simple exploit, we can run our own code at a low privilege level. We can just say, see, oh, wait, the boot ROM is still enabled, and then save it to your SD card. And for that, I was actually not the first one to do this. So StuckPixel and Normat beat me to this for like one or two weeks. And you know, after that, I also managed to do this. Their setup looks like this. So they did use voltage glitching, but they had like a really beefy transistor on there, which is connected really closely to the power supply at the power supply chip. They also desoldered the crystal oscillator and supplied their own clock to synchronize all the glitches even more precisely. And this was all controlled using an ICE40 FPGA. So a quick timeline of this attack. So you have the reset, which happens first. So the console starts booting. You inject a first fault. This takes over the ARM7 boot ROM. So then the first boot stage happens. Now the chips get stuck and you don't see any activity anymore. And then we just keep injecting glitches until hopefully it actually works and the ARM9 gets stuck out of its infinite loop. And then you see a first blip of activity again. That's the second boot stage. And then a lot of activity, which is you know, us reading out the boot ROM. So yeah, this works. And luckily, this also has the cryptographic verification routines. Now, what now? Well, now we can finally start answering the questions everyone has been waiting for, namely, does it have SIGHEX, which is the exploit the 3DS has to circumvent RSA signatures, and also does it have NTR boot, which is a secret boot thing where the 3DS can actually boot from a DS game cartridge, even though it's completely undocumented. And the answer to the second question is yes. It has actually the exactly same key combination with also the magnet trick, which you can use. And then, you know, otherwise, if it doesn't use that, it's either going to boot from eMMC or from SpyFlash. And let's talk about the boot procedure in a little bit more detail now. So there's the ARM9 CPU with its address space, and the ARM7 also with its own address space. The ARM9 has a memory protection unit, the ARM7 doesn't. There's also the SpyFlash and the eMMC. The first thing that happens after all the initialization stuff is that the ARM7 loads the boot configuration bytes from the SpyFlash and then also sends it to the ARM9 using the FIFO interface. It then, you know, typically, the eMMC is selected as the boot medium, so it's going to read the boot header from the eMMC and also send it to the ARM9. Now, this boot header has an interesting format. Now, it has the basic things like the payloads, you know, how big it is, where to find it in the eMMC, at what address to load it to, and it also has the NWRAM mapping configuration because it's complicated and it needs that. And then there's the RSA signature. The usual way an RSA signature works is that you have your data, you calculate the hash of your data, and then you sign that hash. Here they're doing this slightly interesting thing where they calculate many hashes of many blocks of data and then sign the combined hash of that. And interestingly, they combine the two boot blobs, the payload blobs. They also add the header, also an AES key to encrypt the blobs, and then also add an extra hash for extra validation, I guess. But the ARM9 is going to check all that. If it all checks out, it's going to continue. It's going to load the first payload image, which gets decrypted, and then depending on some option in the boot header, it will either directly load it into WRAM, which is then moves the physical block of memory to the ARM9, or there's an option to use compression here, which is going to send the compressed data to the ARM9, and then the ARM9, because it's 4 times faster, will actually do the decompression. And that way it saves probably like a few microseconds of boot time. And then once this, it's going to check the hash of that binary. If it's good, it's going to continue, do the exact same thing for the second binary. And if everything is nice, the console will continue booting and with the second boot stage. Now, this signature format is kind of interesting because it's signing many things at once. And it also contains a key, which means that, the key is never hard-coded. So Nintendo can just push out a new update and change the key if in case it leaks. And the second thing is that you need the RSA public key, which is hard-coded in the boot ROM, which is pretty hard to actually read out. So that's an interesting construction here. But of course, this is also completely custom. And the first thing you've ever heard when implementing cryptography is don't implement your own cryptography. And the second thing is that it uses SHA-1 and RSA 1024, and that's kind of super old. Like, nobody should use it. But yeah, it was 2005, 2006, 2007. But yeah, after looking at this for a long amount of time, I couldn't really find a bug here to easily bypass the signatures. So yeah, there's no way to attack this. Luckily, there's also the SHA-1 thing. So maybe we can attack that. Well, not quite. We can do collision attacks against SHA-1, which means as an attacker, we are free to choose the hash value to then generate a collision for. But that's not the case here. Here we already have the hash in the signature, which we then need to find what's called a second pre-image for, and that's much harder, and there's no attack for that. So yeah, we can't use that. There's also RSA 1024. You've probably heard of the thing where the public key is the product of two large primes, and if you factor that, you can get the private key. And yeah, that still takes too much work, at least for me. The those keys were generated in 2005, so maybe we can do this. There, for example, there's the coppersmith attack and the return of the coppersmith attack and a bunch of other things, because generating good RSA keys is actually really tricky. And if they are vulnerable, you can actually factor the and get a private key super quickly. There's a tool for this, so you can just check it really quickly. Sadly, that doesn't work. Now, I don't have the compute power to brute force this, but the NSA, people think it does. So, instead of spying on everyone, maybe they can get some public goodwill to actually factor these keys. So yeah, here they are. Here's the public keys. Have fun. But of course, that doesn't mean I'm giving up. So let's look at code vulnerabilities instead. Now, the payload size and load address are never checked, so you're just free to have like a 3 gigabyte payload and then load it to an address that doesn't have any memory behind it, and the boot ROM will just do that. But of course, it's RSA signed, so you can't quite get around it. But if you look at the code of the RSA signature stuff, well, its implementation is just going to do an RSA operation, check the padding. If the padding is correct, it's going to copy out all the data and return true. If it's incorrect, it's going to return false. But this return value is actually never checked. So if you just have incorrect padding, it's going to use uninitialized memory as the signature and just continue using it. And the thing is that in the boot ROM, this uninitialized memory is actually always zero. Now, if you remember, there's this extra hash that checks all the other hashes. If this entire thing is zero, well, a bunch of zeros hashed is not going to be all zero, so this check is also going to fail. So, looking at this, there's like almost a bug. So what if we introduce the bug? So time for even more glitching attacks. So there's this piece of code that has two hash checks, which actually jump to the same if statement. That corresponds to this move instruction on the other side. If we glitch this move instruction, we can actually bypass these two hash checks, which is, you know, the header hash check and the redundancy hash check. That does mean we cannot bypass the payload blobs, but we can still probably use this in some way or another. So yeah, what can we do with that? Well, we can actually put whatever we want here now. And of course, as I said before, it's not going to, they're not going to check if it actually makes sense. So what we can actually do is that say, OK, we have a compressed payload. Please just send it to the ARM9, but to the ARM9's stack. So we can just completely overwrite the stack. Now, there's an MPU, so we only have ROP. But luckily, we can use the simplest ROP chain in the world. There's like a call to memcopy somewhere. We can just jump to it, and then we just copy our payload to a piece of memory that's both writable and executable, and then we have full control over the ARM9. And as the ARM9, we can now say to the ARM7, well, there's nothing special to see here. Don't worry about it. Just continue booting. The hash check was fine. The ARM7 will comply, and then in the boot header, we just, you know, the second payload just put that into the ARM9 stack, and the ARM9 has no protection at all, so we can just also take over the ARM7. So that means we have ARM7 and ARM9 code execution before the boot from lockout with only one glitch. But yeah, that all sounds nice, but that's still glitching. That's still kind of annoying in practice, right? So first, I tested the payload in Melon.js. I had to change it a bit. I also added a GDB stub, so I can actually debug code that's running inside Melon.js. And that was actually super useful. And then I can just simulate the fault by just flipping one bit in the bootrom binary, and then it works. Then, you know, because the emulator is still not really hardware, I also tested this in lab setup. And then it basically works first try, so that's super nice. But of course, a lab setup is still not something everyone has at home. So let's design a mod chip now. So what boot medium are we going to use here? Well, a game cartridge. For some reason, the boot ROM is, you know, written such that a game cartridge cannot use the compression options, which we need. So yeah, that's not an option. The second option is eMMC, but we kind of can rely on eMMC because we still want to use it, even though the eMMC is bad. And replacing the eMMC needs BGA rework, which is super annoying, so no. Last option is the SpyFlash, which is luckily much simpler. And well, it would be nice to use EMFI with a mod chip, but no, that's not super practical. So the only option here is to use voltage glitching, because EMFI needs, you know, you saw the pulse generator, it's pretty big. And yeah, that's not going to fit. Luckily, we can also just use a Wi-Fi interposer PCB, which means you just plug this PCB into your DSI and then solder like these two test points, and then it should work. And you know, I spent some time in KiCad, made the PCBs, and actually started validating them. So that's how it looks like installed, with some debug probes actually obscuring it a little bit, which means I can actually demonstrate it. And I have the setup over here. Let's hope it works. So yeah, we have the mod chip installed here. And if everything's correct, it should turn on. And there we go. So can we switch back to the slides, please? OK. So I also have a video as a backup, which, well, I don't really need to use it anymore, even though I spent the entire time yesterday just to get my demo to work, because it broke at one point. And yeah, it's basically going to show the same thing. But an interesting thing here is that it also shows a debug log, which I'm going to explain for a quick second, because I still have quite a bit of time left, which is OK, it froze. That's not good. yeah, that's just not going to work. Oh, well. Yeah, the thing is that it snoops this SPI bus to actually know what time to glitch, and then it basically works from the first or second try because it's actually super stable, which is nice. And then it dumps a few bytes of the boot ROM, and it's super sad that you can't see that. But the slides are online or will be very shortly after a presentation, so you can also look at it yourself. So yeah, as a quick recap, the ARM7, well, I done the ARM7 boot ROM using the vector glitch hack. Then the ARM9 boot ROM was dumped using a double glitch hack. Then I analyzed these boot ROMs to see where there's anything interesting and there's a weak spot against full attacks. So then I made an exploit for that and then made a mod chip to actually make this exploit practical. So yeah, that's about it. The SI, interestingly, it has a lot of custom things. Compared to the 3DS, which has more standard cryptography, it follows the PKCS standard, and that was actually the way it was completely messed up. The 3DS has an operating system, the DSi doesn't, so yeah, it's pretty interesting to see that you need quite a complicated exploit to attack the DSi, even though the 3DS is on paper much stronger, so that actually sort of thickened the encryption, so yeah. And of course, all of this was only possible because they also leaked the second boot stage of the DSi in the 3DS. So yeah, a few years back at another Nintendo hacking talk, people said that, well, secrets hidden in hardware are great unless you give them away. And that's still a conclusion here. So yeah. So I want to thank a few people for this. Suckpixel Normat, who basically did exactly the same thing I was doing, but in parallel at the same time, which is pretty interesting. Arthur and Leonard helped me with all the fault injection setups, especially at the beginning. Nokash for making Unlaunch, which was really helpful and basically needed for doing all this work. Also, Arisotra and everyone who has helped with MelonDS, because that saved me a lot of time. Everyone in these chats for being able to bounce off IDs, and also Nintendo, because this was a fun hacking challenge. Thank you. So, if you're in... No. Yes. I'm almost done, just like one or two more minutes, but I'm more than in time, so it's going to be fine anyway. So if you're interested and want to see how the glitching setups work, there's links here. The slides will be online, so you'll be able to find that. The MelonDS patches for GGB, those are already upstream, so you can actually use it. And people are also already finding this to find exploits in the DSi browser, so that's actually really nice to see. I've been updating DSi Rule with all my findings. And the Mochi firmware is going to be public really soon. Same thing with the exploit payload and what's the start of the new init code, because of course after this you need to initialize all the hardware, then load the homebrew menu or whatever from the SD card so that people can actually use it for practical things like playing games. The Mochi PCBs, those designs are not going to be public immediately because there are still a few bugs in them. And well, of course, there's also bugs in the other code, but updating software is easy. Updating hardware, well, you can't really update a PCB. You have to manufacture a new one. And I don't want people to walk around with broken ones, so you're going to have to wait a bit, sorry. But for people who want a soldering challenge, I've written up a quick DIY guide. I'm probably going to expand a bit more in it because there's no images yet, but it will be. So if you want to try it out yourself, feel free to do so. So yeah, now everyone can dump a boot ROM and everyone can can revive bricked DSIs now. There's like a small thing, of course, the mod chip firmware. It currently hard codes the glitch parameters, which is not good because these can change with like temperature variations and stuff. It also means you don't have Wi-Fi currently, which is also not super useful. And the payload currently, well, it shows a nice screen, but it doesn't do anything else. And yeah, the basic thing is that you now need to draw the rest of the island, do all the work the second boot stage does, which is like initializing the DRAM, initializing the sound, initializing the touchscreen, and everything else. And then also load some games from, or homebrew from, the SD card. I'm one behind. So yeah, all help is welcome here because I probably don't have all the time to do it myself. So yeah, that's the entire presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Poro. For those already leaving, please take your junk, take your bottles, you know, and follow the 6-2-1-plus rule. The 6-2-1-plus rule is 6 hours of sleep, 2 warm meals, 1 hot shower, and wear a mask. I see a whole lot of people not wearing any masks. You should be wearing masks. Anyhow, we'll be taking questions. There's a phone here, a mic here, and a mic there. This is the first question. No statements, questions. One sentence, please. And please be quiet. We're still in session here. While you're going out, please don't talk.
Just thanks for the great talk. I just didn't understand how you got the modifying the WRAM in the first place.
Sorry, what's the question exactly?
So at the beginning, you had to modify the WRAM.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Well, for that, you know, there's already exploits out there so you can like put a file in your SD card, and that's going to exploit like the Flipnote program or the photo taking program, and that way you can get code execution, but it's at a low privilege level. But of course, there's no memory management unit, so you can just write to any piece of physical memory. So just fill WRAM, and then you reboot the console. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Yet, is there a question from the internet? Signal Angel? No? No. Okay, please, go ahead.
Yes, maybe I missed that part, but could you repeat about how you knew when to perform the glitch attacks? Did you use the SPI spy or?
Yeah, so for the very first thing, the vector glitch hack, for that, there was like a huge timing window, and I just had to brute force it all. I tried to use, for example, power side channels to see when the CPU spin up, but that didn't really do anything, so I just had to brute force it. To break out of the loop of the ARM9 infinite loop thing, for that, timing isn't critical because it's stuck in an infinite loop, so you just insert a glitch whenever. And for the final attack, the Moship attack, it's somewhere between the last SPI byte being read from the boot header, and then some kind of SPI thing that's sent to the power management controller to power the LCD screen so that it can show a boot error number. And then it's like somewhere between that time. It's not super long. And then I also just brute forced it, and I eventually found the correct one.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, next try for the internet question. Signal Angel, please. Technology problems?
Yeah. Oh, now it works. The internet has one question. If the glitching did work on other devices of the same model, because they said it's really hardware dependent.
Yeah, so I have a few DSIs at the lab, which I all managed to glitch, so that works fine. But I mean, there's like a little bit of variation between the parameters. Like sometimes it needs to be like a few nanoseconds longer, sometimes it's a little bit shorter. For that, I actually need to automate the training for this in the Moship firmware, which hasn't been done yet, but it's not going to be a huge issue. And also, currently, I only have DSIs because those are cheaper on the second-hand market, but there's nothing stopping this from working on the DSI XL, for example. Okay.
Okay. You people there? One, please.
Yeah, hello. Say hi from the Nintendo Homebrew Discord server. Mm-hmm. And you said that the DS cartridges have symmetric cryptography, while DSi and 3DS have asymmetric cryptography between the console. So how do the DS flashcards work on DSi and 3DS, and how do DSi and 3DS flashcards work?
Yes, so there's this interesting thing where DS games, even though they don't use the hardware of the DSi, that after the DSi was released, they also include an RSA signature. And for the ones released before that, they of course don't have an RSA signature, but for that, the DSi system menu has an allow list where it has like a list of allowed hashes of the binaries of a game, which are then allowed to also run for like all the older stuff. And the way that all the new flashcards work is basically you have to like supply a ROM of the like one of the games which just happened to have a save game vulnerability, and then it just loads up the game, does the save game vulnerability, and then it gets takes over, and then it just shows you the menu of the flashcard. All right.
Thank you.
Okay. Is that a question right in the back there at the microphone? Yeah. Yes, that'll be the second to last, and you'll be the last. Okay. Please.
Thank you for the presentation. I've seen your thing. I think that was a chip shouter. Would you be willing to share the timings for the attacks, including the clocks and stuff like that?
I don't know them by heart.
Yeah, but just somewhere on GitHub or something like that.
Yeah, the Jupyter notebooks are like the only one I did, only things I didn't publish, but yeah, I can put it online if you want.
Just the timings for the curiosity.
Yeah, it was like somewhere between 50 and 90 nanoseconds. I needed at least 350 volts of the pulse, but also no more than 400 in some cases. And
how many clock cycles is that correlates? Only one or like?
It's a few clock cycles, but not many.
Okay, thank you.
Please.
Hi, thank you first. Are the boot ROMs the same thing as what are called the BIOS images?
Yes and no. So for the GBA and the regular DS, those are indeed the exact same thing, which is kind of a misnomer because they aren't really a BIOS, but oh well. For the DSi, you had the public half of the boot ROMs. People read that out and then called that the BIOS because it has all the software interrupt, the utility routines. So I'm just calling the full images the boot ROMs, but it's more or less the same thing.
So the previous images dumped were without the boot code?
Yes, so they only contained the utility routines and the exception vectors.
Thank you.
Okay, let's wrap this up with one final big hand for Poro, please.